Welcome to the Real Estate Dads podcast. Here we are with Glenn Pantone, a seasoned real estate professional in the Las Vegas market who's got some very large projects that he is going to share with us, as well as his history in being a father, where he came from, how he got to have his experience, why he loves real estate. We hope to hear that. And, you know, and just the experience that he's got in regards to being an entrepreneur in the business. So, Glenn, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Max. Do you want me to take it away and just give you a quick background of myself?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Super. So I've been in real estate about 25 years now. I actually had my own company years ago when I was a single dad, and we'll get into more of that, I'm sure, as the show progresses. And I started doing it part-time in real estate, and it turned out to be full-time. I wanted to make a transition full-time. So I sold everything I had. I had a couple thousand in a couple hundred thousand in stock, sold it all, started buying foreclosures. That led to going to real estate clubs and seminars and getting immersed into that. And I ended up becoming a full-time real estate investor. And I specialized in really dealing with investors. Most of the investors I dealt with actually were more or less wannabe investors. In other words, people that had good credit, they had good income, they had good jobs, but and they had money, but they didn't have time to invest. So I led them around the country to several areas, one being Las Vegas, one being Albuquerque, one being Phoenix. We bought a lot of new construction houses back in 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7-ish, North Carolina. Wherever the new construction phase was, we were there. Did extremely well. And then everybody knows what happened in 2008, when not only my net worth, you know, went like this, everybody else's did too. But I found opportunity in foreclosures. And then I just rebranded myself and went from one thing to the next. Did extremely well in foreclosures over a period of several years, and the market in Vegas crashed from literally 300,000 to 100,000. It went down about 66%. And then we just started buying up properties, did extremely well, held on to several of those, sold several of those, did a lot of flips. I've done over 400 flips, mostly here in the Vegas market. Bought a ton of HOA foreclosures, which is a very special niche that most people don't know much about. We were buying homes at 10, 20 grand for a home.
Wow.
Then after time, we lost some of those, we sold some of those, we got clear title on some of those. So that worked out extremely well. And a lot of buy and holds, and I've transitioned now more into larger stuff, multifamily. Just last year, I bought a 24-unit motel, and I bought a 24-unit apartment building that's right close to the Stratosphere in an area close to what's called the Arts District here in Las Vegas, which is being gentrified and turned around. And
I've been there.
That's where I met, you know, Trevor recently, as he's managing one of our, the motel. The cool thing about the motel is that we have short-term licensing as far as rentals go. So these guys are managing our six units of the motel. It's broken up into three buildings, and we're renovating one of them. They're going to manage it. Once we get that up and running, we'll renovate building two and building three. And we're hoping that we can generate huge rental income from that. And then we'll be looking at another purchase probably in about 6 months once this one is stabilized. So that's roughly what I'm all about. So I'm into my early 60s now, but I'm still as active as I've ever been. You know, wealth of experience, wealth of knowledge. And I've got four boys, and, you know, two of them are in the business with me, and the other two aren't. But, you know, it is what it is, and that's what I'm doing.
You know, someone said once to me, they said, you know, when you reach, you know, your 60s, what they said was, those are your power years.
That is
you know, and I had to think about that, you know, because the individual said it to me, because I was, you know, I'm in my 40s and was thinking about, you know, just in regards to, you know, where we are in our careers. And he goes, you know, the older you get, you have more contacts, you have more money, you have more ability to put things together. You've got more confidence because you've got, you know, this wealth of experience of ups and downs, and you know, how to navigate a whole lot more. And he goes, those are your power years, years to really knock the ball out of the park. And I couldn't agree more.
You know, it used to be that it was the 50s. That's a great statement, but it was in the 50s. And now I think as people are getting older and they're moving in a, you know, working longer in some cases, and I'm not working as I have to work. I'm working as I like to work. I love what I do. I'm reading a couple cool books as I'm aging. Of course, I want to live to be 120. And one of the books I'm reading is called The Blue Zones.
Is that really what you're going for?
Yeah, that's my goal. There's, have you heard of The Blue Zones yet, Max?
I haven't.
Good book. Check it out, The Blue Zones.
Okay. And it's about the documentary on that.
Yeah, there's a Netflix documentary. I haven't seen that, but I'm reading the book and I'm almost done with it. But it talks about five or six areas of the world where people live a lot longer. One of them's in Italy, one of them's in Greece, one of them's Loma Linda, California. One of them
I have heard of The Blue Zones.
Okinawa, and then one more, Costa Rica. So, and I've been to most of those areas too.
You know, what's interesting is I really want to die, not young, but I don't want to get old. I want to kick the bucket whenever my mobility has reached a point where it's no longer comfortable. And then I want to go quickly. And that's my goal, which I don't know how that really works.
Well, the book's cool.
You're gonna plan your death.
Yeah, you'll learn a lot about it, because a lot of the reason these people live long is they have a purpose. And give an example. Look at Bear Bryant. When he died, what happened? Or excuse me, when he retired, what happened? He died. You know, and if you've got a plan after, you know, coaching college football or after real estate investing, you've got grandkids, you've got a purpose, you'll live as long as you want to live, as long as you're healthy.
Yeah, I don't ever plan on retiring. We've talked about that on this show a couple of times, but I don't ever plan on retiring. I plan on always staying busy, always staying useful, and always just continuing. You know, I don't ever expect to have that ever stop. So wealth of experience for real estate. You've done a ton. You've got several different irons in the fire. I'm glad you're working with Trevor on some of the short-term hotel business. You know, on a side note to this particular call, Trevor, thank you for the insight that you gave us on our Airbnbs that we've got. You know, we're going to implement those changes, and we'll go into some of that stuff after this call. But I did want to, you know, just mention that was a really valuable information you gave us. But Glenn, in regards to, you know, your personal story, you know, because we've got the real estate side, and, you know, for a lot of us, we've got this kind of, I'll call it, you know, experience in real estate. People are listening to the stories in real estate, and, you know, people can definitely get a hold of you. We'll make sure they get your contact info at the end of this. But you started out with something very, very interesting. You were a single dad. Now you have four boys. So let's go into that. How did that start? Did real estate tie into that on being an entrepreneur? You've got two of your sons that are still working with you now. You know, let's go into that background.
Well, I've got a very interesting story, more interesting than pretty much any stories you're ever going to hear. Trevor met my son a few minutes ago. He probably said, how the hell is he your son? He's very dark skinned. He's of Indian descent. His mother's from Trinidad. And when he was a year old, his mother and I had separated when he was a year old. And she said, he's not yours. And I'm like, yeah, right. You know, because I've been raising the kid. And so we did blood tests during the divorce. And it turned out that he wasn't my biological son. I didn't find out till he was 2 years old as we were going through the divorce. I ended up hiring an attorney in Southern Cal when I lived in the Valley. And he ended up winning the case for me. So I actually won the case. I won custody of him when he was 2 years old as a non-biological son. He lived with me. I continued to take him back to New York to visit his mother. And he's got a little echo there. He's got two half-sisters that his mother was raising that I helped get in the country because they're from Trinidad originally. And I've been able to maintain the relationship with them and continue to make sure that he knew his other family. I didn't pull him away and say, you know, you're with me, that's it. It turned out, funny story, that the bio dad that was fighting with the mom ended up losing, they lost the case. And of course they separated and he was gone for 20 years. And then 20 years later, he wanted to be back in his son's life. And his son, my son, Tony, didn't want anything to do with him. And I said, dude, he's your biological father. You should meet him. He ended up meeting him. In fact, he's flying out today to go back and visit him in Georgia, where he's got three half brothers. And so now they've been able to tie together. And it's kind of cool that I've been able to keep the family pulled together. So it's kind of like when I was growing up, my family got divorced. You know, I was 13 or so. Best thing in the world for me, because I look at every opportunity in life as what are the pluses, not the minuses. Well, I had two families. I had Christmas dinner over here. You
know, so Glenn, this is amazing. So you found out that you were raising a son. You found out he wasn't yours, which I can only imagine was a massive hit. I mean, really, it sounds like, you know, as far as an emotional hit, probably the hardest that I think a man can ever take. You did a massively upstanding thing. You adopted him. You raised him.
No, not adopted. I was the legal parent, because I was the one that was there on the birth certificate. I was the one that raised him. I was the one that sent child support when she moved to New York with him for a few months. So I was the legal father. And then once they decided who the legal father was, it was who's the better parent. And I won that. And so That's how that, even though I'm not biological, I was legal.
So you just retained parenthood rather than.
Correct. Yeah.
And then you still, even after that, helped the mother work with her other half, with her other children that she had back in Trinidad, and worked with your son to still continue to have these relationships with these other family members who were really outside of you. So that's, so that's really amazing. That's really amazing. It's fantastic that you, I'll say it like this, did the absolute most responsible thing you could to help another individual.
And I honestly, I wanted to do what's best for him. If it was best for him to be with his mother and his sisters, I would have let him go, and I would have paid child support, and it would have been fine and dandy, but I felt I did the right thing. He's now married, has two kids. So I've got two grandkids that are local. And it's a very good arrangement. Like I said, he still sees his other family. He's going to go see them this weekend. And that was the beginning of the story. So when he's about 4 years old, as a single dad for the next 2-3 years, I met my current wife, Evelyn, and she had a son that was about the same age, right about 4 years old. And so we ended up going to the park on our first date with our kids. They played, they hit it off, they got along well, and we ended up not marrying for about 6 years, but we had a son a few years after that, after we got together between us, and then we had another son after that. And so we've got our two sons separately together, and then we've got our two sons together, and we've got four boys, and it's a very good arrangement.
That's great. That's great.
So, you have one son. You each have one son outside of your marriage, and then
we have two together. Yeah. Right.
And which two are in real estate with you?
So Tony, the oldest one, is in real estate with me here. And then my oldest son of my biological, oldest biological son, Vince, is 24. He just graduated, well, about a year and a half ago from UNR up in Reno and moved back down after 4 years up there. And he's working with me in real estate also.
And what's the age between the oldest and the youngest?
Well, you got the two 32-year-olds, Tony and Ed, and then Vince is 24 and Giovanni's 20.
Wow, that is a story.
Yeah, it is an interesting story. But funny story that I like to tell, that when Tony and Ed were, 4 or 5 years old, Ed's mother's from El Salvador. She's very dark skinned. Ed's father is a Chinese doctor. So Ed looks Filipino. He's a little bit darker than a typical Filipino, but he's half Chinese and half El Salvadorian. And then Tony looks mostly Indian, and I'm a white guy, and Evelyn's a dark-skinned El Salvadorian. So people literally thought the kids were adopted, or when we were kids, we had a United Nations of children.
I was just going to say, quite a colorful arrival when you get someplace. Cool.
When we had our two, Vince is actually whiter than me, so he's very light-skinned, and Giovanni, the youngest, is darker than me, lighter than the mother. So we literally have 6 different shades of colors and different likes. But the two younger boys look more like me than the mother. But none of the kids that she's had, the three boys, look anything like her at all. They didn't really get her skin color or any of her features. So it's funny how it turned out.
And you said that your parents were divorced. They got divorced when you were 13. That gave you a positive outlook. You said, hey, you know what? I'm going to make opportunity out of anything. Was your father around after that split?
In fact, it was funny what happened there. So the three older kids, we were like the Brady Bunch. So we had 6 kids. I was Peter Brady. And so we had 6 kids. The three older kids stayed with my father in Brockport, which is outside of Rochester, New York, because we were already in high school. So we graduated, lived with my father. And then the three younger kids live with my mother in Greece, which is about 8 miles away, more of a residential or suburban area where we actually grew up as kids, and we moved out to Brockport. They grew up with my mother out there. And as I was saying, you know, I could literally go between towns. So I'd be with this family for a breakfast and that family for lunch, holidays, parties. It was I had two families. And the cool part of it was that my new stepmother had two sons, and then my old stepfather had two sons. So I had 4 more brothers that I didn't have before. So it was kind of cool to have, you know, such a large family. So it really worked out well.
You know, it's interesting about hearing the story because, you know, as an outsider listening to this, it sounds like that, like if I was to hear the story without hearing you say it or see it written down, you know, I would hear a lot of conflict. You know, I hear, you know, a divorce from your personal parents, but that didn't seem to really phase you. It seemed like it just, you saw a lot of opportunity in it. You got some additional family members. You were able to get, you know, another body. I don't know if I want to call it a support body, but, you know, definitely a view of additional family members, you know, after that event. And then with your, you know, your own kids, you know, some trying things. I mean, finding out that your original son wasn't yours, but then having just such this view of opportunity attached to it, where, you know, you now in your 60s have fantastic, what it sounds like, fantastic relationships with all your kids. Was there any strife or conflict that kind of had to be overcome or worked through, you know, kind of growing up through these things? Because it sounds like it would be a lot, but, you know, you have such a look of peace and just happiness regarding the entire, I'll call it, journey. So were there challenges?
No, actually, funny you say that, and I never even realized it till you said that, but you're right. I guess my attitude has always been one of optimism. I'll look at a situation. I look for the good in the situation, not the bad. And, you know, in that, you know, my first family after getting divorced, I looked at the good, not the bad. With my family, I looked at the good and the bad. With real estate, I look at the good with the bad. What's the opportunity? Hey, the market's crashing. Things are crashing all around us. Yeah, that's great. But what's the opportunity? And I've always been able to find the good, the opportunity, whether it's in people or whether it's in real estate or whether it's in family. I've always been able to find that. It's always worked out well for me. So it's I'm, I guess, fortunate to be blessed with that.
That's fantastic. You know, and on a personal basis, you know, my parents did get divorced when I was very young. And, you know, and hearing your outlook on it, I think is just absolutely fantastic, you know, because for me, I think I always did view a lot of the difficulties and challenges associated with it. And those are things that I try not to identify with. But I would also, you know, look back and kind of say, you know, had, you know, my parents not split, you know, this would have been different. This would have been different. I had a massive stuttering problem when I was a kid from stress as a result of my parents not being together. I mean, I couldn't speak until I was probably, you know, fifth grade. You know, I had a massive stuttering problem. You know, you'd never know speaking to me now, but when I was a kid, it was bad. It was really, really bad. And, you know, and some of those things were things that for me, you know, with my family and my own kids is why I take, you know, my family life so seriously and want to make sure that we stay away from some of these kind of things that can be so, so challenging. But I love the information from you in that, hey, these things occurred, but they didn't faze you. It sounds like you just said, hey, life's life. I'm going to keep finding the opportunity, the positivity, and just keep moving forward. And that's even on the family. I mean, you had some, let's move over to 08. So losses in the market. You had, at that time, what were the ages of your kids in those years?
Well, let's see. Vince would have been about 5 and Giovanni 3. And then the other two boys were still, you know, graduating from high school or in high school, late in high school.
And how was that during that period of time? And I had lost a lot of money during that period of time. I had made, you know, decent money through my 20s, and then, you know, I was 28 when the recession happened. I lost everything. I lost, you know, a massive amount of GP allocations I had in real estate assets at the time. And, you know, and I knew a lot of people who you know, personal friends who had, you know, repo men, you know, pulling back cars or taking the TVs off their walls, you know, or recourse debt that was coming through. I knew of an individual who had, you know, them you know, take his wife's engagement ring that he had written down on a personal financial statement, you know, for those years in 08, you know, you had 4 kids, you'd said, you know, there were massive losses after doing well. How did that kind of affect, how did it affect everything?
You know, it's funny. I look back at money doesn't really, I mean, we all have stress of money if we've got bills to pay and whatnot, but and I just remember roughly the numbers, but I was valued, it was worth maybe $2.5 million or so in 2008. Or 2007, by 2010, I was worth nothing on paper. You know, I went from $2.5 million to zero. And then 5 years later, it was worth $10 million. So it's just a matter of finding opportunity, jumping back, rebranding yourself. You've heard the story about millionaires that the first million is really hard to make, but the second million is easy, especially if you've lost it all, because you've already done it once. So you know it can be done.
You have the experience.
Just rebrand yourself.
So you were just like not... You feel like you weren't emotionally affected?
Yeah, I was no different than I was before. You know, one day I'm worth $2.5 million. The next day the market crashed, I'm worth nothing. I was still earning more than I was spending. I lost, I think, maybe 3 properties. Honestly, I only lost 3 properties, a couple of short sales and a foreclosure. One was a fourplex. And it was an interesting break on that one down in Phoenix. We bought, me and a couple other investors bought a group of fourplexes, 10 of them. And we renovated it. We're ready to sell it. We're ready to sell the whole package and like double our money. And then the market crashed. The guy who had 8 of them ended up losing the whole thing. And some of these sold for like 30, 40 grand for a fourplex. So our $300,000 sales, bought them for 150, we're going to sell them for 3. Crashed, couldn't do anything with it. You know, lost our renters, the whole market. So I ended up letting it go as a short sale or foreclosure. I forget which one it was. But it happens, but you just rebrand yourself and move on. You know, one other thing I want to say is we've all heard the old expression about life is 10% of what happens to you, 90% how you react to it.
Absolutely.
It's so true. I mean, so many people I sit around and talk to and like, oh man, but you don't know what I've been through. You know, you don't know the problems I've had. Well, we've all had problems.
They're trapped by their past.
Yeah, you're trapped by your past. You have to literally just forget about the past and move on and look at the good or the opportunities in the future. And I've always had a very short memory. You know, I just forget about the past. Don't worry about it. Don't let it bother you. Don't let it carry with any weight with you. Move on and you know, find what's next.
It's a wisdom bomb you're rocking right now, Glenn.
And it's good. I mean, you just got to be looking at whatever's next.
And was there any philosophical, you know, and this came from a young age. Were there any books you read that, you know, inspired this? Was there any catalyst that, I mean, you mentioned your parents' divorce. Was there anything else that you know, people who are listening are saying, hey, you know what, I want to adopt more of this. You know, I keep using the term, you know, the journey is the journey through life. You know, there's no point in stressing out about the downtimes, but, you know, to your point, you know, how you respond to them, you know, we're always moving forward. You know, what's a way that people who are listening to this can adopt that kind of mindset of, you know, kind of removing some of that stress and just recognizing you have to keep putting one foot in front of the other?
That's a great question, because when I look back at, I guess I've always been, I'll give you a quick example. As a kid, I remember if I was mad at my mother, my brother, my father or something, you know, you go to bed mad, but I was always wake up and I'm happy. And I would relieve that. I was not mad at that person anymore and I would move on. So again, I was blessed with that ability. But the other thing, and you mentioned that, do I read, do I listen to tapes and whatnot? Yeah. When I was a salesman in Southern California for about 15 years, the old traveling university, I was this cassette tapes. I used to buy all those cassette tapes. I've got literally 150 sets of cassette tapes at home. Dennis Waitley, Zig Ziglar, Jim Rohn, any of these guys that Rohn, not Rohn.
Yeah.
Any of those guys that do self-help, Tony Robbins, all those guys. I've got all of their books and cassettes, and I would listen to those things over and over and over and over. And so that stuff is just ingrained in me. I was cut out for it, I guess, in one regard, but the other regard, by listening to that, after you listen to it so much, you just believe it. It's part of your lifestyle. And it's hard for me to think in any other way. And I read a lot too. I'm kind of happy the football season's over, because I'm not a big fan of basketball and hockey, although I'll watch like the Golden Knights and whatnot. But it gives me more time now to read. So I try to read an hour a day. I'm reading 3 books at a time on aging right now. So as I said, I'm starting to think of, if I'm going to live to be 100 or 120, what do I need to do differently to get there? Because so many people just don't take care of themselves. But yeah, reading.
Yeah. So let's go into that. That's going to be a fascinating topic for people who are listening to this, because I don't think it's something that we're going to have a lot of guests who are going to have what it sounds like some of your knowledge about this. So tell us about this, the aging, how to slow the aging, you called them blue markets, blue bands,
blue zones.
So tell us more about this. I'm sure this is, I mean, I'm interested very much, and I'm sure we'll have other people who are as well.
Well, I read a book, and I forgot the title of it, but it's in my phone. I can pull it up later. But it was about aging. And basically she said, you know, as you get older, as you know, you lose muscle mass, right? You don't work out anymore. People tend to gain weight. They don't eat as much. They don't eat as well, whatever it might be. But the first thing I said, hey, you know, I'm working hard, but I want to change my priorities. So starting at the beginning of the year, I started getting up at 3 in the morning and going to the gym instead of working all day. And then you know how it goes. If you work a 10, 12 hour day, you don't have the energy, but physical or mental, to go to the gym. So I reversed it and started going to the gym in the morning. And at first I thought it was tough.
3 a.m.
Yeah, 3 a.m. Well, I usually get up at 3 or 4 a.m. anyways. And then I go to work, and usually I work from 4 a.m. till 8, which is when I get most of my work done before the day gets crazy. But I've tried a couple things that's interesting. One would be I'd work till about 11, and by 11 I'm kind of caught up and things are good. People go to lunch. I would go work out, go home, shower. My wife cooks lunch for me, come back to work. That works. But I was finding that sometimes if it was a busy day, I wouldn't get out of the office to go work out. So I said, if I get up and just go work out in the morning, that worked. So I've worked out more than 50% of the time for the year. I've missed some days here and there. But at the most of the time, I'm up 3 a.m. I go to work out. I go home. I shower. I'm at work at 5:30 in the morning. I still have my 2 hours to get caught up before the day gets busy. And then I can work till whatever, 2, 3, 4 o'clock, some days 5 o'clock. But I'm trying to cut down my work hours this year. So this is my first year of prioritizing my health over my work. I've always been prioritizing health first. It's always been family first, business second, health third. But now I'm looking at health first, family second, business third.
And what time do you go to bed?
Usually 8 o'clock.
Okay.
You're probably pretty sleepy by 8, huh?
Yeah, I'm pretty tired. Point. I mean, I try to read, and this is the part, I try to read at night and I just can't do it because I'll read 3 or 4 pages and I'll fall asleep. But what's worked for me is I'll get up in the morning at 3 and I'll read for maybe 30 minutes or an hour in the morning. Then I'll go work out. Then I'll go home, shower, go to work, and I might get to work at 6:30. But that works. I'm so mentally alert in the morning that I can read for an hour and I can knock out 30, 40, 50 pages, and I get my hour of reading down in the morning rather than the night.
Can you listen to books on tape while you're working out or audiobooks?
I probably could. I am not set up for that yet. I know most people I see in the gym have either earphones or iPods.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I probably could start doing that because I've got the iPods.
I've been doing that, and it's like, it's just what you said, you know, like, but when I'm not hitting 3 a.m. yet, I got 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. on lock. I can do 5 a.m. and then I'm at the gym working out. If I start my workout by 6 a.m. and a lot of the, more than half the time I'm listening to an audiobook. And then, so I get that, like, when I do sit down to work, now I'm like, my mind is right where it needs to be.
Right.
You know, the only thing I've also come to find out is that it's really hard to listen to an audiobook on a really hard workout day, like leg day.
Right.
So like leg day, I don't listen, but on, you know, chest day, which I can do chest like in my sleep because it's just fun. Who doesn't like bench press, right? I'll definitely be listening to an audiobook if I'm doing, you know, back, biceps, chest, stuff like that.
Good. It's one little thing. It's not a big thing, but I always take notes no matter what I do. I'm making notes now, subject points. I'm making notes about audiobooks because I haven't entered that into my protocol for working out. Good idea. So something I'll look at. I was thinking more when I'm on the treadmill or something because fairly easy.
Yeah.
The weight part I probably wouldn't do, but I think treadmill, good idea. I can get my news on there if I want. I can do audiobooks. I can do self-help. So good thought. So I love that idea.
Worth a shot.
That's a good one. You know, sometimes I like listening to audiobooks, and there's other times I like not having my phone with me at all because I find that my workout just gets done quicker if my phone's not with me. Because I find that I have a tendency to check emails. You know, I might check social media. And if I don't take my phone with me, I get a significantly better workout in a more condensed period of time if I don't have my phone.
Oh, Max, you just got it. It's also good training to not mess with your phone.
Yeah.
While you have it with you.
Yeah.
Or mess with the audio while we're on a podcast.
Yeah. This is our first time traveling to do it. So, you know, we'll definitely get better. But appreciate you guys bearing with my tech issues.
It's funny when we were talking about that. It reminded me of something else when I was talking about notes is that I do a lot of speaking in front of real estate clubs and seminars and whatnot. And I do get invited to speak quite a bit. I've never been paid to speak, but that's okay because I love sharing my thoughts and ideas. But one of the things I always say when people ask me, well, I'm a new investor, what can I do? I say, well, set up a Google Alerts. And a lot of people don't know what those are. But if you set up a Google Alert on whatever your subject matter is, you're going to get 8 or 10 different articles or podcasts or whatever the subject is sent to you, emailed every day. And you look at it. Yesterday was the first time in a long time that I showed up on a Google Alert because I was in a newspaper yesterday morning, I believe it was, for a project that Dave and I are doing around the stratosphere in this area called Naked City, which is a very old area of town. We've been buying up a lot of land. The project I was talking about offline is a project that we bought maybe 10 lots in that area and then 4 or 5 lots on a street next to it and about 7 or 8 lots on another street. So we bought maybe 20 to 30 lots in this area. And So because of that, we were interviewed by the newspaper guy. And so I showed up in Google Alert before I got the newspaper. Then I saw the news. Oh, there's my picture in the newspaper. Fine. But the point is, if you have a subject matter, like I said, if you're interested in foreclosures or real estate in Las Vegas or real estate in Southern Cal or wherever you happen to live or be, you'll get up to speed. I was just mentioning earlier that Airbnb, lease options, HOA foreclosures, flips, short sales, foreclosures, rentals, property management. Those are all areas that I've done and that I either own property, I own a real estate brokerage, we manage 300 properties. So I'm well versed in so many different areas of real estate that it's easier for me to communicate about it. But it's because I'm so well versed, because I do stay up to speed on Google Alerts and reading. And, you know, because half of my reading is not just the self-help books and the tapes, the stuff that I listen to, but it's the updates of all the projects that I'm involved in. There's three or four new projects in and around the stratosphere in Las Vegas that were just announced within the last 6 months. 300 units or more that are being built, and we own a lot of land. So we're very excited about what's taking place, but it's a matter of staying in tune as to what the opportunities are.
And in regards to the Vegas market, and this is a little bit off topic from the Real Estate Dads, is the market still highly focused on new developments within that area, or is there a lot of new corporate growth that's within the Vegas market now? Because that's one thing that I remember was a massive factor regarding the 08 recession in Vegas, was that all of a sudden, you know, with no new development, there was a massive exodus of people who were leaving the city because there just weren't jobs that were so tied to construction. Is that changed, or is it still a large portion of it that's built that's, you know, focused on that? Or are there a lot of companies that are moving to Vegas?
It's a good question. And Vegas, since the, you know, the crash, has continued to grow again. You know, we had record numbers. Super Bowl was great. The Formula One race was great. So we're getting more activity now. We have two sports teams, major. I mean, you've got the ladies basketball, but you've got hockey, you've got football. Now you've got baseball right around the corner. The A's are coming into town. So the growth is still there. And there's a lot of new developments that are happening. The area that where we're in is a very old area built in the early 50s. So it's taking a little bit longer for that area to get gentrified. But guys like us that are coming in and taking a street like Philadelphia, and we've torn down four or five lots in a row where there was old buildings. And now people see it and go, wow, hey, there's some activity going on one of the other streets we have in Paradise. We've torn down 10 buildings in a row. So when people start tearing buildings down, we get noticed. And when we sat in front of the city council a few days ago, there was a project that was coming into town in this area, and it's called Transitional Living, where they wanted to have convicts that are released from jail into this area. And it's adverse to what we're trying to do. We're trying to build new development. We're trying to renovate older properties and bring in working class people that work less than a mile away at the casinos. And they wanted to bring in prisoners in this area. And it's like, it's a great program, guys, but we didn't want it in our area of what we're trying to do. So we spoke in front of city council. We represented ourselves as investors in the area, as developers. The Stratosphere general manager was there. He had signatures from all his employees, and it worked out great that they shot it down because the city council didn't want anything to do with it either. You know, they have ideas where this area is going to be new and exciting and brand new construction. So it's going to take a little longer to happen, I think, than other areas. But once that first guy goes out of the ground and starts building, kind of like Wynwood. I don't know if you've been to Miami before, but there's an area outside of Miami called Wynwood. And my partner, Dave, is from Miami, and he said, man, 20 years ago, Wynwood was just like the Stratosphere area in Naked City in Las Vegas. It was old, it was beat up, it wasn't good. And now, Wynwood is amazing. You've got these 8-9-story high-rise projects, the residential living. You've got the clubs, you've got the bars, you've got the restaurants. It's a very dynamic area. It's a safe area. And this is exactly what's happening in this area here in the Arts District in Las Vegas, where things are turning around. If you look at it in 10 years, it's going to be totally different. And so we're on the inside of this.
The path of progress.
The path of progress. It's pretty exciting.
So moving over to politics really quick, how do we as a society work with individuals who are getting out of correctional institutions, and how do we fix this issue?
Do we have to?
Topic
of debate. I think we do. No, I think we do. That's the great point. Let's talk about that along with the homeless problem, because we've realized that in this area, we've got, not only is there a big homeless problem, But when I went to Oakland 2 years ago to watch the Yankees play, and we walked down to the stadium, instead of Ubering, we decided to walk. And the homeless problem was unbelievable. And I know it's bad in San Francisco. It's changed the city. It's bad in L.A. It's a real problem. So with the convicts that are getting out of jail, they obviously need a place to transition if they're going to get back in society. But from talking to police officers and representatives that have these group homes and whatnot, and I do own 3-4 group homes also, where folks that are out of prison, or if they're out of an alcoholic problem or some sort of a problem, where there's a house manager managing them, and they rent the house from me. I'm not involved in the management other than being the owner of the property.
Mm-hmm.
But the group homes have worked really well on a small scale. So my answer is twofold. If you're going to do this project with the transitional living of folks getting out of jail, it's got to be in a smaller scale where it's easily manageable. But the bigger picture is the homeless, because the mental issues, apparently, from what I heard talking to the police and the representatives, is about 50% of the people that are released from prison have mental issues.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the reason why they're in jail in the first place. So I believe we have to have somebody big, like a Jeff Bezos or a Bill Gates, come in and say, let's build literally a city or a facility where we can put them all. Kind of like, you know, prisons. We have prisons and we put people in prison, and it's good. But if we did the same thing with the homeless, that I believe is the solution. You can't be on the street. If you're found on the street, you go to this facility. We try to get you back into society. If we can, great. If not, you stay there, kind of like a prison, but you're not a prisoner. You can come and go as you please.
So Washington is trying exactly what you're talking about.
State or
Washington
DC?
State. Washington State. They have this program. I got two brothers in Washington, one in Seattle and one across the Puget Sound in Bremerton.
Okay.
Bremerton. And the state of Washington pays hotel owners nightly rates to keep rooms open for homeless people,
okay,
essentially, right? They are paying hotel. They are putting homeless people up in hotels, right? And since they started doing that, homeless people have just flocked. Now, where my brother lives, used to be a pretty quiet, small town. It's just full of homeless people everywhere. He's a firefighter. The number of calls he's going on has like quadrupled in the last decade, right? So now the fire department is inundated with calls for issues that happen with these people, right? And they're leaving places trash. There's needles everywhere. No one would even want to stay in the motels anyways at this point because they're so, you know, trashed up.
Right.
And then these hotel owners are like, they're basically transitioning the hotels to exclusively catering to homeless. So, you know, on the one hand, like, it sounds like a great idea. Let's just get a rich guy to just handle this problem for us, or have the, you know, like the state is doing.
Right.
But then on the other hand, like, if you give free things to people, there's just going to be
right.
more and more and more.
Yep.
The demand will never stop.
Yeah.
And it'll just balloon.
Yeah. I think part of this in regards to what Glenn, and I think that many people have had this kind of thought, is that, you know, there's two things. There's the NIMBY, the not in my backyard, which is really what a lot of people who are wanting to regentrify areas are struggling with, because, you know, the factors of bringing in, you know, a lower affluent population, you know, they hurt businesses. They hurt businesses who are going to be charged, you know, in regards to loss of business, in regards to, you know, their operations, which also affects tax dollars for cities. And you end up with these situations where you've got exactly what you're describing, where you've got a collection of body of people who are damaging to the building of a society that needs to really be there to really even collect enough tax dollars to manage the issue. And we're talking about, you know, a facility that can be built. You know, I mean, I think the idea would be that it would potentially not be built within a, you know, a location that has a lot of, you know, hopefully, you know, gentrifying business that's growing for the people who are, I'll call it, well, tax paying members of society, but built in a location that's a little more remote, where we are actually, what I would hope is rehabilitating people, you know, actually getting them to a position where they want to, you know, rejoin society. And the mental health issue, it's a large one. And, you know, and that's one that I think most people really struggle with, because there's this kind of sentiment in California where, oh, well, they just need housing. But the reality is that housing isn't really going to fix the issue if you're talking about a mental health struggle.
Correct.
And that mental health struggle for many of these people, from, you know, talking to many people who volunteer with the homeless, many people who are within, who are homeless, they don't want to rejoin society. They have become very much comfortable living, not
in society. They don't want to come back to a job that they have to show up to on time. They don't want to pay taxes. They don't want to have to do the things that require a lot of responsibility, because they, in many ways, to Trevor, kind of what you're mentioning, they've been given services, and as a result, I don't know what the exact number is for Los Angeles. Say again.
They're content with what's being handed to them.
They're content with what's being handed to them. And within markets like Los Angeles, they've spent billions on the problem, and it has grown the issue. It has not fixed it. It has actually made it larger. And they've made, in many ways, access to drug paraphernalia easier. They have, made camping on the streets easier. And there have been situations where these individuals have had their lives become, somewhat convenient to be living, in this method. And, I think that's the struggle. What I really wanted to come back to in regards to, this topic of, how do we correct, these issues? And really, while we're in this really hard spot right now of how to really help this body of people, because I think that's really the issue. Most people see individuals who are homeless, and most people don't have a heartless view, but it is a question of how to actually help them. Some people have a little bit more of a tough love mentality, where others have a little bit more of a, hey, let's throw more money and, kind of accommodations at the issue. Which one is the right one, I would argue, is probably more in line with a little more of the tough love rather than the accommodating the lifestyle that doesn't help. But on a better note, what I'm going to come back to with Glenn, and this is what I was really going to bring up, is, these individuals who end up on the streets, who end up using drugs, didn't start out of nowhere. It started at home, started probably with a bad family life, and it started with an individual who didn't actually have someone who was really a good resource to their family. And very specifically, Glenn, you being there to, raise Tony, your oldest son, and then to be a father to, your, the son that you, of the woman that you married, that you later had two kids with, you have done very much what we want to see more of in society, of, having parents who are actively involved in the growth of their kids so that they stay away from these activities and behaviors that end up potentially with really serious pitfalls, and not just a damage to them as a personal individual, but that now as a society, we want to help and get these individuals help and assistance. And it's hard. It's late. And this is where, this is really, really the reason I brought it up when you said it, you said these individuals, and I just see, what you've done with being such a, really a great father to all your four boys, is that, we want to see more of that. That's what I personally would like to see in regards to society, is having more families take active roles with their kids, so that, we don't end up with this percentage of people that are on the streets, addicted to drugs, and having mental health issues, which is probably a combination of those things.
I have a question about that for you.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah. Like you got two. I mean, I see what you're, and everything you're doing, like, looks, really successful from an outside perspective, including two of your sons, half of your kids are in the business with you now. How did you get them interested in that, in real estate or in entrepreneurship?
Well, that's a good question. And I've been always one to say, show kids something and let them decide. So I've never pushed either of them to be in the business. So Tony, my oldest, has been in the business really for almost 8 or 10 years now. So he's pretty engrossed in real estate. He owns 3 rentals, married a couple of years ago, has kids. So he's got a nice trajectory from where he's going. My younger son, I'm not sure this is going to be his career of choice. I think he's just kind of working with me and doing his thing, but he's got other goals in life, and I don't foresee him doing real estate full time, although he wants to own real estate, which is a good thing to own. But I've always, given them the opportunity to do what they want to do. And I think that's the right way to do it.
Just show them, just let them see. Yeah, did you take them to, business meetings?
Yeah, Tony, starting out, we used to go to my real estate club with me. He became a real estate agent. He was in the military for a little while. When he came out, he became a real estate agent. So that worked. And Vince was 4 years up in Reno, and he managed the house that I bought for him. Called it the Bro Mansion. It's probably famous. But so he had 6 or 8 guys, that went to college living in the home while they went to school. Learned a little bit more about management of a home and all that. And that worked out well for him also. And the other two have no interest in real estate, just like they have no interest in sports. I mean, I grew up playing sports, loving sports. Two of my 4 kids have nothing to do with sports. They don't even know what a football is, let alone, know all the ins and outs of all the different sporting events and all that.
What are they doing?
Well, one of them's into computers, and he does improv, which is interesting. He's a very quiet kid. That's Evelyn's oldest son. He does improv. He'll probably end up on Saturday Night Live someday, and we'll be proud of him, of course. And the other one is real quiet. He's going to school. And he's doing some graphic design and whatnot, but he's a very quiet kid. So.
And with these boys, raising them, you just mentioned, you know, introducing them to things and seeing if it sparks interest. You know, what things, when they were growing up, did you introduce them to? Like, how is that process showing them?
Fortunately, I've done fairly well. So we've always been able to travel. And as a family, in fact, we were just looking at our next vacation. Every Thanksgiving for about the last 10 or 12 years, we go somewhere as a family. And that's getting expensive now that we have, four kids and two is six. And then we have two grandkids and the wife. So now we're up to 10 or 12 people. And it gets more expensive, obviously, to take everybody to Hawaii or take them to Mexico or wherever we're going. So lost my train of thought. What was I talking about that? So we've traveled a lot. And that's one of the things I've always enjoyed with them. I'm somebody could call me a workaholic. Yes, I work a lot, but I do take time off. I take my vacations. And when I do, I'm unconnected. I try not to be at work. We go back to New York to visit my family where I grew up every year. And then we take our other 3 or 4 weeks a year elsewhere, international travel here and there. But I've always tried to, at least expose them to travel and other things. And that's worked out well, I think.
That's good. Yeah, a lot of exposure to not just what we see on a day-to-day in our local environment. I'm guilty of that all the time. Whenever I travel, I always come back with new fervor for the job and a lot better understanding of how much more there is out there than what we just see on a day-to-day. That's the biggest thing I see was when I travel, I go, wow. Because you forget how big the opportunity is. You just see your local set of people who are wealthy. You travel to any place in the world and you realize there's an entire other body of wealth and next level and other things that are just not in our normal scope. So it's fantastic to do that with
sure.
For me, it was always easier for me to travel on vacations when I had a W-2 job. Now that I'm an entrepreneur, man, the vacation seems so hard to get time off to go do.
It should be the other way around, really, because you're in charge of your time. So, like anything, you have to schedule it. You schedule and you say, this is my time and I'm not involved otherwise.
Yeah.
So,
were you good about when you were done for the day working? Well, first of all, like being done before it's too late to have effective time with your family, and then having that effective time, like being there in the moment and the work day's done and now you're here.
Well, that's a good question. I've always said that, like I said, I'm a workaholic, as I've been told by my folks or my family. But I do always put family first. So if there's a family function, I'm there. I'll plan around it. But, typically when I get home in the old days at 5 o'clock, now I'm trying to get home at 3 or 4 in a lot of days, but still 5 o'clock some days, depending. I don't have a lot of time with the family for that. We have dinner time. We've got a little bit of time and then it's time to go to bed. And I do work weekends, but I work a lot less. I might work 6 hours on a Saturday morning and 3 on a Sunday morning just to catch up and keep things going where there's no disruptions. I can get more accomplished really on a weekend. But if I'm home by 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock on a Sunday, and my wife's just coming home from church, I haven't missed anything. So I've always had the family time there. But at the end of the day, when you work as much as I do, you don't. I'm going to say, people, I'm not the best father in the world, but I'm not by any means a bad father. I still give a lot of love and attention to my family. But if you were to rate me versus the other guy that's doting on his kids and doing everything with them, that's not me, because I'm focused on work and making money. But that's, again, the first half of my life. The second half of my life, I plan to do the other way around, where I'll be the greatest granddad in the world because I'm spending more time with them, taking the grandkids on vacation. Versus where I might not have been able to do it when the kids were young because I was focused on work so much.
Well, yeah, I think that's also a relatively natural progression, and I would argue that, for you right now, 60, going to live to 120, which I think is very real. Half, you got plenty of time.
Right. Like anything, people drop dead all the time. You hear, this guy just dropped dead. He got run over, got this, got that. It happens. We never know when we're going to go, but what I found is if you plan to live a long life and you're healthy enough to do so, there's a good chance you're going to do that. And if you look at the book I'm reading, The Blue Zones, there's many people that they've taken good care of themselves. They work. They still work. Some of these people are 100 years old and they're still working. They still have a physical activity that they do, but that keeps them young and that keeps them with something to do. And they're
planning for more life.
Yeah.
Ikigai
or Ikigi or something. Yeah. So I'm all good.
So Glenn, we're going to wrap it up here. And I want to thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing just really such a wealth of information, both on, you know, I'll call it your fierce responsibility to, you know, being a father to all four of your boys, and to, you know, your career and being so unswayed by, seeing you be so successful because you never let the times that were hard really affect you. You know, you just moved straight through and recognized that was just part of business, and it was something that's kept you, you know, productive and to a point now building more life across the board and planning on having just such a long life of accomplishments that, you know, you're really just still barely getting into. I mean, when we look at it in that sense, there's so much more to have happen. So how do our guests get in contact with you? You've got investments, you do look for investors. How do the guests find you?
Yeah, I will give you both my cell and my email. Those are really the best methods. Cell is 702-769-9872. And then my email is the best way, really, because I can get back to you at my leisure based on my schedule, is part of my name. It's G as in Glenn, S as in Sam, and then my last name, Plantone, Plantone at gmail.com.
Glenn Plantone. Great.
Is it Plantone or Plantone?
Well, if you go to Italy, it's Plantone. And when we went over to Italy, it was kind of cool because it was, hey, Plantone. But over here is Plantone. You know, that's the way it goes.
Gotcha.
All good.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all for listening. And you can get more information on Glenn also at our website, realestatedadspodcast.com, where you can get access to information. We will get the copy of the Blue Zone book that Glenn has referred to a couple times on the blog there. And we also have access to the Slack channel where our listeners can connect regarding real estate deals, both for presentation as well as to invest in others. So thank you again for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode. Thanks so much.